Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
What if AI could help your business deliver mission-critical outcomes with speed? With IBM Consulting, your business can design, build, and scale trusted AI using Watson X and modernize the way you work to accelerate real impact. Let's create AI that transforms your business. Learn more at ibm.com/consulting. IBM. Let's create.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, welcome to Weird House Cinema. This is Rob Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick, and I regret to inform you right at the start here that the Weird House Cinema tour bus has broken down in Florida, so we are still stuck in the Sunshine State.
That's right. We're continuing our look at Florida movies from the 1970s, movies filmed in Florida, and certainly in the case of today's film, and also 1972's Frogs, which we covered previously, set in Florida as well. They capture a certain Florida-ness, both real and imagined. And this week, we're going to look at the Florida movie par excellence, 1971's Zat. You might know it as The Blood Waters of Dr. Z. Some of you might even know it as Hydra. It basically, as we'll get into, it had a number of various releases over the years under different titles. But for the most part, the one that stuck is Zat, Z-A-A-T.
This movie has some thematic overlap with other movies that we've looked at, including sort of like Nature Strikes Back movies, though this is not exactly Nature Strikes Back. This is more of a... sort of cheap body horror mad science movie with some ecological themes to it rather than just like animals attacking for revenge on humankind.
Yeah, it's, I guess at heart, it's a creature feature, but like a lot of films that you encounter like this, certainly like the first big independent efforts from filmmakers, It tries to do a lot of things, so it's a creature feature, but it's also like a science team adventure. It's also it also tries to be in the heat of the night a little bit. It also has this Nature Strikes Back element to it. It's also a kind of a hippie folk musical, so it kind of bats itself around a lot, and depending on where you are in the film, you might get something that is tonally different from another portion of the film.
It also has a little bit of overlap with Boggy Creek 2 and The Legend Continues. We can talk about some of the similarities as we go on, but I appreciated the similar pompous voiceover narration, though in this case it is the voiceover of a crazed, spurned scientist who wants revenge on the world, whereas in Boggy Creek 2 it's just a kind of, I don't know, like the town smart guy who wants to show off all his knowledge about the river.
Yeah. The voiceover narration in this is sardonic to the max. Like if you took Vincent Price's voice and you reduced it over heat for a little bit until it was just extra icky and gooky, that's what you'd have in the Bloodwaters of Dr. Z.
The voiceover narration wears Joker makeup.
Yeah. Now, if you mentioned Boggy Creek earlier, and I think this is a good point to mention that this film was riffed in a 1999 episode of Mystery Science Theater 3000 under the title The Bloodwaters of Dr. Z. And if you're like me, that might be where you discovered the film. That's a great MST episode. I don't want to take anything away from that. As I would watch and rewatch that episode, I found that, like a lot of MST episodes that really called to me, there was something in the underlying film. There was an awkwardness to it, a kind of loneliness to it. And I've also grown to really appreciate the Florida-ness of it as well. So for this episode of Weird House Cinema, this was the first time I watched an unriffed version of Zat, which rented from Atlanta's Videodrome video rental store. And ultimately, I encourage fans of the MST episode to do the same, because like a lot of MST films, it was really edited, really cut down for time. Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot of stuff that you're missing out on, some really wonky and at times grotesque details, and sometimes just ludicrous additions to the film.
This is not of the Attack of the Crab Monsters school of creature feature runtime. You know, it's not your 63-minute abs. This one, I think, is actually getting close to two full hours, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it's 100 minutes long. It's plus size, this one. So you have to set aside a little bit of time for it. And again, the pacing is at times kind of weird, but also hypnotic. Quaaludic at times.
Uh-huh.
Now, we mentioned the MST episode, and I think a lot of people did discover it through that. But the film has had a cult following outside of MST as well, despite only having a limited release in Jacksonville, Florida, and New York's 42nd Street back in 1972.
The version we watched, it begins with a statement from the director where he's like, people were coming up to me and saying, Don, you've got to release this movie.
Yes. So, yeah, I think it was people really wanted some sort of a release for a long time. And luckily, in recent years, it has been available. But, yeah, this film, like the Scorpion Fish, and the Sargassum Fish, it's been patient. It knew that it would one day conquer the universe. And it has its super fans, one of which is the Atlanta artist and Jacksonville native R. Land, who I know we're both fans of. Have you seen any of R. Land's Zat pieces, Joe?
Oh, I don't know. I've seen a lot of his stuff around town. A lot of, you know, restaurants and coffee shops and stuff mm-hmm. will have R. Land pieces up on the walls. I think some of his work also, though I don't quite recall how, was featured in some Adult Swim shows. I could be wrong about that. But no, I don't know which the Zat ones are. I know his piece that's like the divers with the spear guns. Is that Zat related?
That one might not be. I mean, he works Florida into a lot of his pieces, but he did create a number of art pieces that actually feature Zat. He did a show as part of a 2009 screening of the film at the Plaza here in Atlanta. And at least some of the pieces, I assume, from that show were that they used to hang out over at Joe's Coffee in East Atlanta. And I would go there and bring my laptop and work. I don't know. There may still be some pieces there. I haven't been there in a spell. But, images of Zat. And he had some spinoffs over the years as well. Like there was one that was like a real estate sign that says Zat did it again. and then he recently did one, at least online, that was a Zatterday thing. It was pretty amusing.
Very nice.
But yeah, he's apparently a Zat mega fan, and you know, a lot of people like him out there, you know, where you see this maybe when you were younger and something about it sticks in into your brain and you can't quite get it out.
All right, what's the elevator pitch on this film?
A lonely mad scientist in Florida hatches a plan to raise an army of giant walking catfish and avenge himself over his colleagues and also conquer the planet, perhaps the universe, and we're left to follow him and see how it works out.
Let's hear that trailer audio.
And now, Coming to this theater, one of the most incredible stories of modern time. Zat. Invasion of the Walking Catfish. A crazed scientist, Dr. Leopold, is convinced he can turn humans into fish. He proves it by transforming himself into a horrible, revengeful, killer fish. Zat tells it all. You won't want to miss Zat. Positively no one admitted during the last 15 minutes.
Okay, now you would not have expected a movie like this to have major folk music themes, and I don't know if the trailer audio we just played had the folk music in it. If not, maybe we should insert a clip right here, just because, like, you've got to have this in your head to understand everything that comes after.
Oh yeah, I mean, we can go straight to the music here if you like. This what we're about to hear is a bit from a song titled "World War II Boy," which is a very strange title. But this is from Barry Hodgen and Jamie DeFreitas. They were the composers, and this is Jamie DeFreitas performing the song.
Give us a break, give us a break.
That's just a clip, but this song is performed in its entirety at the top of the film. And I actually love it. I listen to this song quite a bit, especially in the last couple of weeks leading up to this episode, because you can find this on Spotify and various other streaming places. If you just look up Zat songs or Jamie DeFreitas, you will find it. There's a B-side, and we'll get to the B-side track in a bit. But these tracks are featured in the film in full, no cuts.
Yeah. So it's almost a rock opera. I mean, yeah. Not quite. Only a couple of songs in the movie, but like it has musical numbers.
Yeah, and I have to say, I mean, we'll get into this a little bit when we start rolling through the plot, but yeah, the music always elevates the film. If you have quality music, it can really create dimensions that would not be there otherwise. And I legitimately think that the music in Zat, both the folk music and some of the other music we'll get to, does a great job of that. Like, it takes this sort of awkward, fumbling creature feature and elevates it to this level where it does legitimately get caught up in your brain.
Do you ever hear that story? It was by somebody who worked on Halloween with John Carpenter. It might have been Donald Pleasance who told the story about going to see a preview screening of the movie where the music had not been added in yet, and thinking like, oh no, what a disaster, like, I'm so embarrassed. And then seeing another cut later when the music had been finished and added in, and suddenly everybody thinks, oh, this is a horror masterpiece.
Yeah, I mean, it really does. It can really elevate things to new levels. Though shocking that Donald Pleasance would find embarrassment in a film at that stage of his career, because it's not like this would have been the first bad movie he was in.
This come before or after Puma Man?
Ooh, I don't recall. Oh, but either way, there were definitely some Puma Mans in there before Halloween. All right, well, we'll come back to more about the music in a bit, but let's start with the screenwriter, or one of the screenwriters, and the director, Don Barton, who lived 1930 through 2013. So he was very much alive to see the renaissance of Zat, the resurgence of Zat. And in fact, the disc that we watched featured introductory commentary by Don Barton, thanking everyone for their support of the creature here.
Yeah. He shows up right at the top of the film. And I should point out, this disc, it's one of those that doesn't even have a menu in it. It just, you just put it in and it just plays. The only option is play. But it starts with him talking, and Don Barton says, in 1971, my film production company in Jacksonville, Florida, decided that the time was right to make a feature film, meaning this was his first feature film. He'd only done one other movie before this, which we'll talk about in a second, which was a short film. But he says he sat down with his staff to discuss ideas. Quote, and we decided that our first motion picture should be a creature feature. So this turned into an idea, I think, talking with some writers and associates of his about a man-catfish creature that terrorizes a small town in his quest for revenge. And then Don Barton says that the initial theatrical release was very promising. He doesn't elaborate on what exactly that means. But he says that due to unspecified mishaps, the film had been unavailable for like 30 years at the time that it was re-released. Though I wonder, I mean, there must have been some way people got it, because they must have gotten a tape of it for Mystery Science Theater. I'm not sure what.
Yeah, though I think even that there were some issues. If I'm to understand correctly, like there was a situation where Sci-Fi Channel, I think at the time, aired it, and then Barton's people got in touch with them, and there was some back and forth about like the rights, but it eventually got worked out.
Okay, that makes sense. But man, when I was watching this preamble by Don Barton at the beginning of the movie, I kept thinking, who does this guy remind me of? His something about his voice and the way he talks. And then I realized he reminds me of the TV news host Bill Moyers, who used to do like, I think he worked for, he did specials for PBS, and then I think he worked for CBS for a while. But so like, I got that feeling like, oh no, this is like Bill Moyers introducing a PBS special on Zat that's going to feature interviews with Joseph Campbell.
Yeah, it does have that kind of vibe. Now, we mentioned Jacksonville already, and we will mention Jacksonville some more. Barton was Jacksonville-based. He was a producer and director. This was his second and last directorial credit following 1969's They're Out to Get You. But he was apparently involved throughout his life in the Florida film industry, having co-founded the Florida Motion Picture and Television Production Association. And he also produced documentaries, training films, TV commercials, etc.
And this is actually more the genre that They're Out to Get You was. So They're Out to Get You, I was really looking for an online copy of it, and I couldn't find anything. But if somebody out there has better sleuthing capabilities, please send this our way. This is not an entertainment film. They're Out to Get You from 1969 is an educational short that I think was supposed to be shown to retail employees. So it's like one of those, you know, harassment or ethics training video, workplace videos they show you on the first day at a new job, except it is about shoplifting. And the plot of it is that there's this young criminal, or at least this is the alleged plot. I had to find a summary somebody wrote online. There is a young criminal named Tony Alto who steals cars for a living, and he gets caught and sent to prison. And in prison, his cellmate turns out to be this, this smooth guy who's going to tell him, no, stealing cars, you're doing it all wrong. Here's what's up, shoplifting. And he explains to him why shoplifting is a much better way to make a living by stealing. And so as you go through the narrative, I think it shows the tricks that shoplifters could be using in your store or your store or yours.
So it also sounds like it's just in general a shoplifting training video.
Yes.
For either side of the equation.
Well, it's kind of like how D.A.R.E. was supposed to scare kids away from doing drugs, but instead it was just kind of like, here are all the different kinds of drugs you could do.
All right. Well, let's talk very briefly about the additional story credits. Ron Kivett and Arnold Stevens, and also Lee O. LaRue. Not much to report here. Though Ron Kivett was apparently an investigator on History Channel's Ancient Aliens at one point. So
what was he investigating?
Aliens, I guess, or pyramids. One of the two, probably. But that's the main creative force behind the picture that we're going to discuss here at the top. It's time to get into the cast. And the film is initially concerned with only one human being and devotes a good 20-something minutes to just him. And that is our signature character, our main character, Dr. Kurt Leopold, played by Marshall Grauer. Now, this is his one and only film role, and for a long time, I assumed that he only did the physical performance, that we're seeing Marshall Grauer and somebody else is providing that just overly sardonic voiceover that we were talking about, that again is just like Vincent Price turned up to 11. Vincent Price without any humanity left in it at all. The voice of just an overacting demon. But he apparently did the narration as well. Leopold, the character, the human character, never speaks on camera. Not a single time, but we have just this voiceover at length describing what he's planning to do, what he's doing, his ultimate aspirations are. It's a lot of fun. But I would say Marshall Grauer is just delightful in this film because the voiceover is just it's so rich. It's just so overdone. And then physically, he has this weird combo of sinister awkwardness and this kind of outsider sadness, which when you throw in the sort of film quality of Zat, it feels like you're watching a window into someone's personal hell, you know?
Dr. Leopold is a human with the personality of a car that's having maintenance problems. He's having trouble accelerating. He's releasing dark, foul-smelling exhaust. Like he needs to get his catalytic converter replaced. But also the thing that I realized about him, there's a scene early in the film where he's walking along a beach, but he's not dressed for the beach. He's wearing long slacks and a shirt tucked in, and his head's hanging down in this kind of like sad, like puppy dog way, except he's more drab than a puppy dog. And you know, there's this acoustic guitar strumming in the background. And he's just this beacon of shabbiness. In some shots, he's giving off strong Harry Dean Stanton fumes.
Yeah. I think that's a good comparison, that kind of drawn, haggard appearance. Yeah.
But on the other hand, he has a haircut that doesn't quite match, because I don't know how to describe his haircut. It's very strange. It's kind of messy and moppy in the front, but also... to make it weirder, so it's a haircut that I think I've basically only seen on women before. It's a cut style that's kind of puffy up in the back and raises up toward the back or the crown of the head, and then goes flat down toward the front. Do you know what I'm talking about?
I'm having a hard time picturing his hair in my head. All I picture is that face, and then later that bod, which we'll get to.
Anyway, he's a profound screen presence.
IMDb does not list birth and death dates for Grauer, but I was looking around and I think I found him as being listed as buried in a cemetery in Jacksonville, and he lived 1922 through 1991. And if I have the right guy here, and I'm pretty sure I do, he was pretty active in the Jacksonville theater. So, and I would not be surprised if that's where ultimately a number of these actors come from, actors that in many cases have no other movie credits listed to them.
Thinking about this guy being active in Jacksonville theater got me off on a tangent that I actually think about a good bit when we're watching these B movies, especially locally produced B movies, movies that are, you know, not a product of LA, but, you know, come out of Florida or somewhere else in the country. And it got me thinking about how acting talent translates across from stage to screen and the disconnect that can occur when somebody spans these two worlds. Because I was thinking about a story where a longtime close friend of mine, he used to do some local theater directing in Tennessee. And he was at one point directing, this was years ago, but at one point he was directing an adaptation of a Tennessee Williams play, I think. And he ended up working with this actor who, according to him, was just magical on stage. You know, one of the best actors he had ever worked with, and was spellbinding. But we found out this guy had also been in a few movies, and I don't recall the exact titles, but they were just like Z-grade horror movies, you know, Chupacabra Rampage 9 or something like that. And so we watched these, and this amazing local theater actor was, you know, just not especially impressive in a direct-to-video horror context. And I remember having a kind of revelation at that point that, like, oh, you know, stage talent and screen talent are not always interchangeable, and context really matters. Like, somebody who can be a very good actor when they've got good material to work with. Like a lot of the people who do these Z-grade horror movies are probably a lot of times doing Shakespeare or something, you know, mm-hmm. in local theater, or they're doing Tennessee Williams plays or something like that. But then when you put them in a catfish monster movie, the whatever talents they've developed for those other acting contexts just don't really translate. But there's a good chance in any given B movie that there are plenty of members of the cast who are no names in the film world, but they're like the best actor in their local theater group, and they're used to doing Shakespeare or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, I guess there are so many different ways you can cut it. I mean, on one hand, it's the difference between the stage and being told by a director, yeah, we're filming this next scene in the basement of this building, or just walk on the beach for a little bit. Yeah. No, I don't know what your motivation is. Just walk on the beach, and we'll fill you in a bit. We're still writing that part. You know, so stuff like you can imagine the distance between the two projects, on top of just how, you know, colossal an undertaking any level of film is. Not to take anything away from a stage production, which of course is also a colossal undertaking in so many regards. But mm-hmm. But the tools that aid you in one dimension might not aid you as well without some re-tinkering in the other.
Yeah, certainly true. But I mean, I think it's important that people should always keep in mind, if you are a fan of Z-grade horror movies and the kind of stuff we talk about on this show, you should always remember that whenever you're watching one of these films, there's a good chance that the actor who is completely failing in front of you right now is actually great in some other context.
Yeah. Now, Leopold will eventually turn into a monster, and we'll detail that at length. But when he is a monster, he is played by someone else. The monster is played by Wade Popwell, who lived 1948 through 2006. This was his only film role, and he apparently answered a newspaper call for tall actors who were also experienced scuba divers.
Oh, yeah. This was a funny thing I read as one of the many trivia facts claimed about this movie. I guess I'll cite several of these throughout the episode. There are a number of interesting facts that are claimed on the IMDb page for this movie that are unsourced, so I can't verify them. But at least the claim is that he was recruited through a newspaper ad, like you say. Mm-hmm. It was basically like, we need a really tall person who's going to play a monster, and they got like tons of responses. Like people were Florida was into this.
All right, the next acting credit to highlight here, Gerald Cruz played marine biologist Rex. He doesn't have a last name, as far as I know. This was his only film role, which ultimately surprised me because I thought he had a nice screen presence in this as the African-American marine biologist who is the first to realize that something is wrong.
Yeah, this movie does something that a lot of these creature feature or Nature Strikes Back type movies do, which is there's somebody who's like the voice of reason, you know, the cooler head who's putting together the evidence while everybody else around them is just sort of like reacting erratically and emotionally. And he plays the cool head in this movie. Like he's the person who's out there saying like, oh, there's pollution in the water. And oh, here's this report of a catfish. And this wound on the victim looks like a giant catfish claw mark, I think he at one point concludes. I'm not sure that really lines up with reality. But like, that's the role he plays in the movie. And he's set opposite, for example, this sort of like redneck sheriff who's always got a piece of straw hanging out of his mouth, or yep. I guess a piece of hay. And he's always like, well, I don't believe in monsters.
Yep. Yep. And that is Sheriff Lou Krantz, played by Paul Galloway, who lived 1923 through 2015. Like everybody in this, wasn't in a tremendous much else, but he played Garage Man, which I assume is a bit part in J.D.'s Revenge from 1976, a New Orleans crime drama starring Glenn Turman and Louis Gossett Jr. In this film, however, yeah, he plays the small town sheriff who is lazy and largely incompetent.
Yeah,
but in the later portions of the film shows a little bit of hustle, but not quite enough.
He's one of those characters who is not the antagonist of the film. He's not a bad guy, but he's just sort of he's a roadblock. He's just sort of getting in the way of what needs to happen happening.
Yeah.
Now, another thing I should point out is that this is one of those movies where you see a few repeats during the credits. For example, Paul Galloway here, who plays the sheriff, he was in the cast, but he was also a unit manager. And then I saw in the credits that Ron Kivett, who was one of the writers of the film, was also the technical director and did some of the costuming. And I think there were a few others like this. So it's not all the way to Neil Breen or Coleman Francis tier, where the director is also getting credits for catering and event security and stuff, but there is some repetition going on.
All right, a couple of other actors that we'll mention. Santa Ringhaver plays Agent Martha Walsh. Dave Dickerson plays Agent Walker Stevens. Both of these actors, these were their only film roles. But these two, we'll come back to them. There are Mulder and Scully in that. They work for a shadowy organization known as NPIT.
Yeah, they get called in by Rex, the marine biologist. I could not have told you these characters' names. For me, they were just NPIT Agent 1 and NPIT Agent 2.
Yeah. Now, another character that the character's barely worth mentioning. There's a deputy sheriff in this, but it's played by an actor by the name of Rich Valerie, who lived 52 through 2018, was only in 8 films, but they included small roles in Jaws 3, The Road to Wellville, and Night of the Hunter.
Well, he was in Night of the Hunter? Wait, no, he would have had
not,
to be very
not
young.
Not that Night of the Hunter, Joe. The 1991 made-for-TV Night of the Hunter, starring Richard Chamberlain and featuring Burgess Meredith and Ray McKinnon in a small role.
Okay, that would make sense. Now, for him to have been in the original Night of the Hunter, he would have to have been, I guess, 3 years old when he starred in it. The original Night of the Hunter is a scary movie. Man, talk about spellbinding actors. That is one of the all-time greats for me in terms of a screen presence that you cannot take your eyes off of. Robert Mitchum in that movie is scary as hell.
Yeah. But what if we remade it in the early 90s with Richard Chamberlain in the role?
Okay.
Supposedly awful.
Okay.
Now, that's enough with the cast. That's enough with the humans and the monsters. We need to talk just a little bit about the music. And then the next few people of note are responsible for the music of Zad. And the music of Zad is pretty great, even if it's a bit all over the place as well, which is kind of suitable. It encompasses more traditional late 60s, early 70s film score work, which some of that I suspect is stock music. But then it also has like folk rock. It has ambient synth in there. So there's some uncredited stock music in there per IMDb by Trevor Duncan. So it's kind of all over the place, but there's some really interesting stuff in there.
I was not really won over by the electronic music in this one, which mostly just took the form of like kind of painful high pitch noises and screeching.
Oh, really? I ultimately really like
that. Or at least that's what I recall.
Yeah. Well, it is like that. It is kind of noisy at times. It kind of gets into that Dr. X territory where, we discussed in that film, there are these scenes that have ambient mad science noises in the background. Sounds a lot like it is some manner of like modern post-industrial electronic score. Mm-hmm. And so that definitely has that vibe going on. But I actually really liked it. It's, in my opinion, I thought it was pretty effective. It was synthy, kind of noise, ambient. And the electronic music like this in the film, and I suspect some of the background electronic weirdness, is the work of Jack Tamil, a Floridian synth musician. And if you look him up on Spotify and other digital platforms like that, you'll find some rather haunting nature ambient recordings that he's done, such as Voices of the Everglades of Everglades State Park and Gator Bellows in the Everglades. Ooh. Both collaborations with James T. Miller.
Okay.
But he also put out some excellent space music in the 1980s and 90s, including The Referee Has Vanished from 1986, Meditative Massage from 1992, Synthiest, I think it is, from 1982. And then,
that's a religious affiliation, obviously. I am a Synthiest.
And then there's a 1980 album he put out titled Electroacoustic, like electro/acoustic, which was released on Spectrum Records. I couldn't find any of these available in the normal places online, but I did find a YouTube upload that consists of Electroacoustic, The Referee Has Vanished, and sounds from Zatz Audio. And you can also, it looks like you can still pick up Electroacoustic used on vinyl. I was listening to it. It's pretty good. I enjoyed it. Okay. Also, not surprising, the number one YouTube comment on that track that I mentioned, it's R Land chiming in and saying, thank you for uploading this.
Commenting with his real name.
Yeah. Another Jack Tamil track that you can look up. On Bandcamp, there's a comp titled Escape from the Cage, Volume 2, Into the Underworld, originally released by Oracle Music in 1990. If you look that up, he has a track on there. It's called Ember Days, and I thought it was rather nice.
Hmm.
Anyway, that's Jack Tamil. That's the electro, synth noise background that you'll hear. But again, the folk music, that comes to us from Barry Hodgen and Jamie DeFreitas. Their story is kind of interesting as well. According to the blog Bill Ektrick's Place, Bill is an Ocala-based writer and blogger in Florida. DeFreitas lived in Jacksonville at the time, and he was a traveling musician, supposedly opened for the likes of Willie Nelson, Janis Ian, Little River Band, et cetera, various people that were making the rounds in those days. And he ran a recording studio in Jacksonville and is still active. I looked him up. He has had a website. Some of these guys, their websites kind of come in and out. But Jamie DeFreitas. So you can look him up on Spotify, and you can find the music from Zatz. It's pretty nice.
Interesting. Well, Rob, I regret having yucked your delicious synth music, and maybe I should give it another shot. I just recall when I was watching it, there was frequently like a high pitched noise that was starting to kind of make me feel a little woozy.
But then again, you have to remember, like, that's kind of what the music is supposed to do in a film like this. It's to build that sense of unease and alienation and Floridian weirdness.
Well, I'm there.
Seth, give us just a little taste of some of that Jack Tamil music before we move on to the plot.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Is getting gas at Chevron burning a hole in your wallet? What if I told you can easily earn cash back while you fill up? Introducing Drop, the app that turns every fill up into a reward. With Drop, you'll earn points to get free gift cards every time you fill up your tank. Download Drop and use code DROP77 to instantly receive $5 in points to jumpstart your savings journey. Don't miss out on turning your gas expenses into something rewarding.
AI might be the most important new computer technology ever. It's storming every industry, and literally billions of dollars are being invested. So buckle up. The problem is that AI needs a lot of speed and processing power. So how do you compete without costs spiraling out of control? It's time to upgrade to the next generation of the cloud. Oracle Cloud Infrastructure, or OCI. OCI is a single platform for your infrastructure, database, application development, and AI needs. OCI has 4 to 8 times the bandwidth of other clouds, offers one consistent price instead of variable regional pricing. And of course, nobody does data better than Oracle. So now you can train your AI models at twice the speed and less than half the cost of other clouds. If you want to do more and spend less, like Uber, 8x8, and Databricks Mosaic, take a free test drive of OCI at oracle.com/strategic. That's oracle.com/strategic. Oracle.com/strategic.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
All right, Joe, let's get into the plot of this baby.
Yes, let us tell the story of a man who dreamed he was a catfish, or was he a catfish dreaming he was a man?
A true tale of metamorphosis, of mythic proportions.
Absolutely. So the movie starts, of course, the version we watched has that great intro from Don Barton, again, with the Bill Moyers energy for me. But then it gets right into the film with stock footage. I doubt this was shot for the film. It looks like something from a nature documentary where it's showing off sargassum seaweed, as we have just discussed on the core episode from yesterday, and a real nice prickly looking fish. And we get voiceover that at first I thought was a poem. It really sounded like he was reciting a poem because he says, "Sargassum, the weed of deceit. Sargassum fish, mighty hunter of the deep." Okay, so that's almost like a near mm-hmm. rhyme there. So you think he's developing a poem, but then the stuff he starts saying after that doesn't really fit. He starts saying, "What an inspiration you have been in my plot. Your life of hiding, waiting, stalking your prey at just the right moment. Attack! I love you."
What are you, the poetry police, Joe? You're saying this isn't poetry?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, what I was trying to figure out was whether the movie thought it was a poem or whether he was just talking. anything's a poem if you say it is.
Now, it is such a startling start to this picture, because again, it's clearly stock footage, and the voiceover is just amazing. And I do love the idea of somebody on early 1970s 42nd Street in New York City walking into this picture, thinking they're getting some sort of a sleazy monster movie, and they're hit with documentary footage right off the bat.
And just the guy who sounds kind of like Vincent Price telling this fish that he loves it.
Yes.
I love you.
And then he goes on to admire various other species for minutes at a time. The shark, "I admire you. Soon I'll swim with you. They'll be afraid."
Yes. Yeah, very good. And the scorpion fish, an objectively ugly, beautiful fish, like a fish that is beautiful in how ugly it is. And he's like, "You are gorgeous. They think I'm insane. They're the ones who are insane."
Yeah, it's pretty tremendous.
Another thing that's cool, though, is that actually the stock footage they select, I don't know what it's originally from, but whatever nature documentary it is, they got some cool footage because Monster Science moment here, they catch a sargassum fish eating another fish whole, like just spreading its mouth wide and clamping down over this fish's body. And the fish that it eats is almost as big as the sargassum fish itself.
This reminds me that in the actual science episode we recorded yesterday about this organism, I neglected to mention that apparently sometimes when it eats another fish, since it's you can actually see the prey inside of it through its semi-translucent skin.
I've seen that. Yeah.
So that's so wonderful. I love it. I don't want to be it like Dr. Leopold here, but I do like it a lot.
Oh, I don't know if we mentioned, that's how he follows up. So he's looking at the sargassum fish and he's saying, I love you. But then he says, I hope I'll be a good imitator.
Yes. Basically, he begins to lay this out through, you know, ultimately like 20 minutes of narration, that he is going to draw inspiration, perhaps behavioral, but also genetic inspiration from these organisms as part of his master plan.
I think you already mentioned this, but we should stress it's like 23 minutes into this movie before you see a human being who is not a mad scientist.
Right, right.
Up until then, it is exclusively Dr. Leopold looking like Harry Dean Stanton shuffling around on the beach and through the ruins of a marine park and stock footage of animals from the sea and then a monster just sort of rambling around.
Yeah, most films, you know, they'd probably start off with like a teenage couple meeting, they're relatable, and then they're killed by a monster or something like that. Yeah. Not this film. No, it's Dr. Leopold and stock footage of fish from the get-go.
We do get a teenage couple fooling around later in the movie when the monster is on a rampage. There's this this young couple that are like on a porch swing and they're making out, and the guy's like, I don't believe in monsters. And then, of course,
a good hour and a half into the picture, you get what is probably an opening segment in most films.
Yeah, but yeah, how to describe that? There is a powerful emotional resonance to the opening of this film when you first see Dr. Leopold wandering around. I mean, I guess we've already tried to describe it 9 different ways, but yeah, it's Harry Dean Stanton-ish. It's shabby. It's drab. It's sad. It's lonely. He is failing, and he is going to do science to fix it. Oh, and of course, we should mention that while we see him wandering on the beach, this is when the World War II Boy song is playing. And one of the lines in the song that is just a kiss on the top of the head from the sun god. It's the part where he says, sashay, sashay through the sargasm.
Yes. I could go on and on about just how wonderful that song is. Because the lyrics, the lyrics sound like lyrics that were composed after half watching part of the film, you know? Just sort of like trying to loosely figure out what the plot is. Like it refers to your calendar research, which just seems like a strange description of what appears to be going on in the motion picture. But also it ultimately, like, I don't know, it ends up giving Leopold more depth because he's talking about, how he's wanting to change himself. Outside you change yourself to be inside what you already see, you know, which I guess is kind of like, you know,
which is, you know, a catfish.
Yeah, he's already a giant catfish. I don't know. It ends up working for some weird reason. It just works very well.
The true catfish was inside you all along.
Yeah.
So I've got a question about how a filming location here matches up with reality. I don't know if you have any insight on this, but I'm wondering. So after we see Harry Dean Stanton here wandering through this desolate beach landscape while the World War II boy plays, he wanders into a place that looks to me like the ruins of an off-brand SeaWorld, like if a Marine World type attraction was abandoned for years and just, you know, things collected all over it as the seasons came and went. That's what we'd be seeing that he walks through. I know that part of this movie was filmed at Marineland of Florida, but from what I can tell, I think it was actually in operation at this time, not like an abandoned ruin. So I'm not sure exactly what we're seeing.
Yeah, like there's a scene where he's walking around or through what looks like what's previously a tank of some sort, and now it's just empty and has leaves and clutter in it. I guess my thinking is twofold on this. First of all, just because Marine World was up and running didn't mean there were parts of it that maybe had fallen into disuse or weren't being used, you know, the outskirts of the facility, that sort of thing. I think if you go to you go to your local zoo or botanical garden, there's going to be a part of the property where you could probably film a scene for a monster movie, you know?
Yeah.
On the other hand,
it could just be off season. I mean, maybe it looks that bad just in the winter.
That's the other thing. Like, we have to remember that Florida is Florida and it is a jungle. So, we're talking about just like a few months without anybody paying attention to the maintenance of a place, and it'll look like absolute ruin, you know, which I think is one of the appeals of certain Florida movies as well. The Florida ruins.
Yeah. Okay. So I'm going to guess that this is actually part of Marineland, Florida, which is a place that is operated off and on, and I think was also a filming location for Revenge of the Creature, a very strange Florida movie indeed.
Yeah, probably the best Creature from the Black Lagoon movie, if one can say such a thing about Creature from the Black Lagoon.
It's the sequel to Creature from the Black Lagoon, and I think it's the one where the creators have realized that, like, oh, in the original Creature, the humans were definitely the bad guys, right? Yeah. Like, the creature didn't do anything. It was just living in its own place, and then humans showed up, and they were like, let's shoot at it! And we're supposed to think that the humans are good for just going to a place where a monster lives and killing it.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the creature was the character that we all relate to and associate with. And I think a certain similar thing is going on in this film as well. I mean, the creature from the Black Lagoon or Zat, they are both literally fish out of water. You know, they're literally outsiders. And, you know, that's the sort of thing you often relate to in a film like this.
Mm-hmm. Though I will say, I will make a strong distinction, which is that I fully side with the creature because he's just hanging out in his place and they come there and start attacking him.
Right.
Zat is the aggressor. Zat is trying to work out scores in a way that is not productive. He could have, like, if he was mad at his former coworkers, he could have written them a letter saying, like, here's what I think are our unresolved issues. Instead, he's like, no, I'll turn myself into a catfish critter and come to your house and kill you.
Right. He's very clear on this. It's not just, I want to restore ecological balance. No. He wants to basically all but wipe out the human race, hunt the remaining humans for sport, and proclaim himself ruler of not merely the Earth, but the universe. So he has some grandiose plans here.
Dr. Leopold, you are asking for more than is your due.
Yes.
But of course, so we see Dr. Leopold still in human form at the beginning. He goes back to his lab, which I think are probably some places at Marineland of Florida. I'm not sure, but they're places with like hoses attached to the ceiling and stuff like that. It kind of equipment that you would imagine might be in an actual marine biology lab or marine veterinary clinic or something.
Yeah, and I think they cobble together a lot of stuff, too. Like, there's a black light stuff back there. Not black light, dark room equipment in the back at one point, you know. So, clearly, you know, they took some initial clutter. They filled it up with some other technological stuff. But it ends up looking good. I felt like I feel like this is an adequately lonesome and mad science-y layer.
Yes, it is. It is very dingy. It is very damp. It is very dank. It is it doesn't look like a place you'd want to sleep.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, we get some classic mad scientist dialogue while he's fiddling around with his equipment. He says, the formula they all laughed at. My little Jim, Zat. And we find out that Zat is it's like a formula. It's like Z sub A sub T, I think.
Yes. Yeah, I believe so.
Okay, so it's like it's a mathematical or chemical formula of some kind. But he tells the through the voiceover, he says it's very powerful. They'll have fish the size they've never seen before, walking fish who like human flesh.
Okay.
So he wanders around the labs a lot. He stops to tickle an octopus, which I liked. He just reaches into the tank and kind of like touches it a little bit. And then he starts doing voiceover about this one species of catfish, the walking catfish, which according to, this is another one of those claims that was listed on IMDb unsourced, but according to the claims of, Kivett, one of the writers, he got the idea for this movie by reading an article about this species of catfish, the so-called walking catfish or Clarius batrachus. But anyway, this voiceover about the catfish, I wondered if this was actually written for the film, because it sounds like he is reading from an encyclopedia or a field guide entry. And I was wondering if somebody could find the text, but I was Googling sections of what he says in quotes and I came up with nothing. But I wonder, maybe I'm just not looking for it quite the right way. But then he goes on a rant about how there's a problem with the walking catfish, which is that it is too small. And he tells it that you are not ready to battle humans. But then he says, soon the whole world will know and respect us. So I'm a little confused about his plan, because he's going on about how all the humans will be killed, but then he also says that they will finally respect him. So I don't know. Maybe it's that they'll respect him before they are killed.
Yeah, I guess at the very least. But also, you know, he does allude to the fact later on that some humans will be alive, possibly. Maybe those are the ones who will respect him.
All right, well, no more screwing around. It's just time to inject myself with the giant needle, and that's what he does. He grabs this needle that is huge. It's like a feather duster sized handle, you know. So it looks like it was designed for saltwater crocodiles, and it's full of some kind of green Gatorade looking liquid, and he just jams it straight into his arm.
But that's just phase one of the transformation. First is the injection.
Right. Yeah.
Next comes the kind of a baptism.
Yeah, he's got to get into a tank. So he gets undressed. He's wearing these huge blue boxer shorts with his butt kind of hanging out, and that's funny. And then there's this pool of water, and I think there is some blood mixed in with the water, and then there are these Geiger counter sound effects in the background. So I think something is supposed to be radioactive. This pool of water may be – it could be that it's supposed to be heavy water, because later on some characters talk about how his laboratory – Dr. Leopold's laboratory used to do heavy water experiments.
Ties right into previous episodes of Stuff to Blow Your Mind.
Yeah, I mean, as we discussed in that episode, as soon as you get into a pool of heavy water, you turn into a catfish creature. So the science checks out. But then he gets himself into this kind of winch gurney thing. I don't know how best to explain this. It's like, it looks like a device that would be used for airlifting comatose dolphins.
Yeah. It's fittingly awkward and ritualistic. It's an unsettling scene because he doesn't just climb in. Yeah, he lowers himself into it on this thing.
Yeah. So he gets in the gurney, he lowers himself into the water with a rope, and then we get electronic beeps and Geiger counter clicks, and then finally he emerges and he is the creature. And then we will never again, the rest of the movie, see the actor who plays Leopold. He's just gone.
That's right. All we have is this fabulous monster.
So it's not like a were-catfish movie where he's changing back and forth. He's just this creature permanently.
Yeah, and I think this is one of the things that always captured my imagination about the film, is that instantly we look at this and we're like, oh, sweetie, you have really done it now. This is not good. But he has different thoughts about it.
Oh, yeah. So as soon as he gets out of the water, he looks at himself in a mirror, and you think for a second he's upset. But no, he turns it around. He says, nothing at all like a catfish, but it's beautiful. And what is he talking about? Well, I would say that he looks like a cross between Greedo and Alf, except he's got a sort of like dirtier texture than either one of them. So it's like if you cross Greedo and Alf, but then have that creature fall into a puddle of mud and dead leaves that get stuck to him. Mm-hmm. And then he's also got green fur around certain parts of his upper body. I think it's the parts where the sort of shirt part of his suit comes together, because it's similar to the white fluffy parts of a Santa suit.
Yeah, he looks a little bit like the Grinch at times, you know?
Yes.
And he has kind of like Grinch physique.
Yes, he does. That's a very good comparison. I didn't think of that. Some parts of his body have a kind of Peter Pan garment shingled leaf texture, or maybe the Green Giant has some clothes that look like this, the shins in particular. But also he has a snout that ends in a leech mouth. Well, it's kind of like a leech mouth. It's like a red circle with teeth in the middle, but they're not those circular leech-like teeth. They're more just kind of like a dog's teeth with canines.
It is not even remotely articulated, though.
No. The painted-on teeth, basically. Yep. And according to the writer Ron Kivett, this is another one of those IMDb trivias, the monster has this mouth that looks kind of like a leech's mouth because in an earlier version of the script, he was supposed to suck blood out of his victim. So he was going to be a vampire catfish monster. But I think they scrapped the sucking blood, but the costume was already made, I suppose. Yeah. Okay, so he's transformed, and then we get to a part that I legitimate laugh out loud part of the movie, which is when he goes to his big to-do list on the wall. Mm-hmm. He's got this wall it's like this giant disc-shaped wall calendar that he's got his upcoming tasks written on, and we see him go up to the cell on this calendar labeled self-transformation. And he crosses it off like, oh, there's one thing off my to-do list. And then the next item on the list is another instance of the word transformation, but it is next to a drawing of the outline of the state of Florida. And this drawing is labeled FLA period, which is the correct AP styling of abbreviation of Florida, which makes me think we may have a journalist decorating this set. Because I don't know if you remember, I mean, we used to have to know AP style when we were writing for How Stuff Works. And
it's hard to shake.
Yeah. Everybody just uses the postal abbreviations now. Or maybe they didn't have the postal abbreviations in 1971. I don't actually know.
Well, at any rate, this is the calendar research that Jamie DeFreitas was referring to.
Yes.
And I don't know, Joe, I think this is just how you had to do things before modern project management software.
Right.
Helped you keep track. You just had to have a giant circular calendar chart on the wall, taking up enormous real estate in your mad science lair.
Yeah, and you had to draw pictures of the state that you're going to transform. So he draws Florida. Transformation, I guess, of Florida. Another hilarious thing about this is that next to the drawing of Florida, there's a label of the ocean, and it's just labeled Atlantic Ocean. But, like, who was going to be confused? Wasn't he just making this for himself?
Maybe he wasn't sure, you know, after the transformation, you know, his brain might be a little foggy. He'd need lots of visual clues.
That's a good point. Yeah, like he couldn't predict his future mental state. So he's like, maybe I will be confused and I will need to relearn geography.
At any rate, it looks weird and I like it. I actually made a Christmas tree ornament based on it at one point.
Oh, that's good. So the Leopold catfish monster goes out on the town. He goes out equipped with a spray bottle and just starts spraying nature, I think with the Zat formula. So he sprays snakes and frogs, and he sprays reeds at the water's edge. He goes swimming and then uses the spray bottle underwater to spray an octopus and a crab. You see him literally with the spray bottle, like, under the water, just squeezing it and...
Now, yeah, so we have some underwater photography going on in this sequence and then in some sequences to come. And I don't know if you noticed, Joe, but we have some very clear underwater sequences here. And I believe that's because they were filming in the various springs of Florida, which even today, they're not as clear as they used to be due to environmental reasons and runoff and so forth, which is, depressing, but even now, very clear waters. And back in 71, yeah, perfect place to shoot your monster movie, even if you were doing so on a budget.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I should have noticed that they really did not look like the cloudy, stagnant pond water I would imagine in most of North Florida.
Yeah.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Tired of wandering the aisles at Walgreens trying to find the best deals? Well, we've got something that'll make your shopping experience a whole lot sweeter. Introducing Drop, the app that rewards you with free gift cards just for doing your everyday shopping. Whether it's groceries, toiletries, or your favorite snacks, with Drop, every purchase earns you points towards fantastic rewards. Download the Drop app now. Use code DROP55 when you sign up to get $5 in points.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Attention campers, the new Camp Snoopy at Kings Island brings your family summer camp fun all season long. Head to Camp Snoopy with Charlie Brown and the whole Peanuts gang for fun and adventure. Race forwards and backwards on the new family boomerang coaster, Snoopy Soapbox Racers. Explore on your own with more space to roam at Beagle Scout Acres. And don't forget to grab a snack at Pigpen's Mess Hall. It's a new way to play with the Peanuts gang at Camp Snoopy. Now open, only at Kings Island, for the fun of it.
So, yeah, we are 23 minutes into the film before we finally introduce non-Leopold humans and actual dialogue. One human character talking to another human character.
Unbelievable.
So here we introduce the sheriff and Rex, the marine biologist. And if it's not clear at this point, it becomes clear that they were sort of going for in the heat of the night thing here. This is, you know, based on a novel, 1967 movie directed by Norman Jewison that saw a small town southern sheriff, played by Rod Steiger, teaming up with an African-American homicide detective from up north, played by Sidney Poitier. And yeah, that is nowhere near in the heat of the night in terms of serious drama and cultural commentary, but it seems to be like that's what they were going for here. They were thinking, hey, what if it was like in the heat of the night, except there was also a giant catfish?
Yeah, this is something we've seen in a number of these other like ecological monster movies from the 70s. They also seem to try to inject some social commentary in there. It's often kind of light and not super deep. But yeah, I think that is probably what they're attempting. Is Rex, the marine biologist, also supposed to be from out of town? I don't recall if that was the case, but
I don't remember if it's expressly stated, but it feels implied that he's not from around here. Yeah.
And so there's a general suggestion that there's this rigid, parochial, local, white, conservative infrastructure that does not process the introduction of knowledge about pollution causing monster attacks. It does not incorporate that information well, and it sort of requires the expertise of somebody who provides a different perspective. And so it's got, in this case, an African-American scientist who may or may not be from out of town, but at least is reacted to that way. Mm-hmm. And of course, as we said earlier, the redneck sheriff in this is literally chewing on a haystack when we first meet him. And generally seems to be derisive of the concept of science and expertise.
Yeah. he's kind of a Floridian Wiggum from The Simpsons.
Yeah. In fact, the sheriff, there are a lot of people in this movie that the sheriff shows he does not respect. And that includes hippies, the press. At one point, we have a reporter who's trying to cover the issue, but the sheriff's just like, somebody ought to smash you flat. And then, of course, he's not fond of out-of-towners, scientists. I think he represents Southern cultural rigidity.
But that's enough human stuff. then we come back to Leopold once more.
That's right. Leopold, he comes back to the lab after he's been out there spraying stuff, and he goes up to another thing on his big wall calendar, and he says, "Mattson, your days are numbered." Again, I think this is voiceover, and we have no idea who Mattson is, but I think the point is he's got a grudge against some scientist who he worked with who told him that his theories were too extreme. I think this other scientist told him he was taking it too personal, and he didn't like that, so he's going to get his revenge.
Yeah, and this is where you begin to, I mean, it's already been an awkward transformation. We've watched him move around. Zat the monster, I mean, his name's not Zat. Sometimes I think of him as Zat, though, again, Zat refers to the chemical, not the monster. The monster's just Leopold, a giant fish. But he moves around so awkwardly. Certainly on land, it's really hard for me to buy that this is better than your human form. And in the water, okay, I guess he's marginally better in the water than a human would be, but it's already seeming to go in kind of rocky. And then he's like, you know what? I also, revenge is part of my plan. And then it's like, so he's not only going to attempt to unbalance the ecosystem and bring upon a new age of fish. He also has some petty revenge agendas in there. He also needs to commit murder crimes.
Oh, he's got several. He gets sidetracked on a lot of stuff. So yeah, he's got revenge murders. And then at some point later on, I think he becomes lonely and he wants a fish wife.
Yeah, he goes the classic Frankenstein's monster route, and yeah, he wants a companion. And so that's additional. You know, it's just the budget on this plan is just getting blown out of proportion.
Right. He decides he needs to, at the last minute, add in a Bride of Catfish action item, and that's how things really go off the rails. So at first we just see him creeping around on various people. He creeps on Rex, the marine biologist, while Rex is out taking samples of nature. He creeps on a woman who's painting beside the lake. He creeps on a family while they're fishing, and then he ambushes them, sort of flips over their boat, and I think kills the dude. And I think the dude who was fishing was one of the scientists who doubted him.
Yep. That seems to be the case. Though one of the problems is that we get less and less narration from Leopold as we go.
Yes.
And I don't know if that's by design, like he's becoming less and less human, so there's less of that voice in there, or if they just ran out of time. I don't know. But we're increasingly on our own to figure out what he's doing and why he's doing it, and even if he's doing something successful.
Yeah, and so at some point, Leopold attacks another one of the scientists who doubted him, but he attacks him in his house, not in the water. And I was just noticing at this point, like, wait a minute, does Leopold even really have any catfish powers? I mean, I guess you were sort of alluding to that a minute ago, but like, this murder could have just been done by a big human. He just attacks a guy in his house and chokes him, I think.
Yeah, the only possible answer I can think of there is that human Leopold does look kind of shambly and puny. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure if he could have pulled this off. So I guess arguably monster form is better.
Okay. But also at some point here, evidence starts mounting that something weird is going on with pollution in the water and the Leopold attacks, and Rex is on the case. Rex starts putting the pieces together. One point he's out collecting data with a net, and Leopold is swimming in the water underneath his boat, and he tears up the net. And Leopold's like, "Nets are harmful to fish. We will use them for humans, if any survive."
Yeah, it's like, let's not get ahead of ourselves, Leopold.
Yeah. But Rex ends up summoning these people we talked about before, the INPIT agents. INPIT, I think, is an acronym. I don't know what it stands for. I tried to look it up, and there is something called INPIT, but I don't think it is what is being referenced here. So I really don't know what it is. Rob, what would you say is the deal with them?
International Nature Police Information Technologies? I'm not sure. I guess they're kind of like, they feel like they've arrived from a TV show. Like there's a TV show where they investigate strange nature happenings. They have their own van. They have jumpsuits, by God.
It's like the A-team is here.
Yeah. They're the professionals. They're here to get stuff done. But it does feel like they're coming from an entirely different television show. And in indeed, they may feel like this if you're watching it unriffed for the first time, because a lot of the INPIT stuff was cut from the Bloodwaters of Dr. Z edition on MST3K.
Okay. Now, they arrive in this big camper, like RV, basically, and mm-hmm. they are dressed in these red uniform jumpsuits. So they look kind of like they stepped out of Flash Gordon or something.
Yeah.
And they compare notes with Rex, and they talk about all the pollution he's found and how this might be affecting the mutant marine life attacks. And so they start putting the pieces together along with Rex. Now, we mentioned that, unfortunately, Leopold gets distracted from his transform everybody into fish. Well, I don't know if that's what he's ultimately – his whatever it is he's doing, he gets distracted by deciding that he must make a bride of catfish. Mm-hmm. So he goes back to the lady who's painting by the lake, who's still there. It seems like maybe days later. And he kidnaps her and takes her back to the lab to turn her into bride of catfish, and it doesn't work.
Yeah, it is a lonesome and disastrous episode in the ascent of Dr. Leopold here, where, yeah, she dies half-transformed, still in the baptism cage thing. And then afterwards, he has to get rid of her body. And this is another sequence that was cut from the MST version. What does he do to get rid of her body? Does he feed her to fishes or anything like that? Nope. He dissolves her in a big old vat of Hollywood acid.
Ah, our old friend.
Yep. It's a great sequence. All while we have some like weird, you know, weird Tamil electronic music going on in the background.
And we see him test the acid on a fish. He dips a fish in the acid and it eats away half of it.
This film is not concerned with wasting anybody's time.
No.
We're going to do an acid scene and we're going to spend about 15 minutes doing it.
We got to make sure that our catfish monster is doing quality assurance on his acid.
Yeah.
So we see Rex and the in-pit agents set up traps for the monster. I guess at this point they suspect there's a giant catfish monster somehow. And they set up traps and then they chill in a camper. And this part also reminded me of Boggy Creek 2 and The Legend Continues, where they will set up traps in the woods and then chill in an RV.
Mm-hmm.
But eventually the catfish monster attacks them and they somehow scare it away, I think with a camera flash. And they end up getting photos of it.
And it's a really good photo. This is another place where Dr. Leopold is just really messing up. Like, oh my goodness. Now you've been completely photographed and it's crystal clear.
Yeah. So they get perfectly good photos of him. There's one part somewhere in here where Leopold is, I think, sad and defeated, and he goes back to his lab, and you see that he is sad, I think, about the fact that he failed to successfully turn the woman he kidnapped into Bride of Catfish, and so he starts drawing her, but the picture he draws of her does not look like the woman that he kidnapped. It looks like Elvira. I don't know, maybe he was supposed to be drawing somebody else. Did he have, like, a long-lost love? Is that implied in the movie?
I don't think that's even implied,
but
you know, we're left to figure out a lot of this on our own. So maybe it is, or maybe he just was like, this was my one shot at romantic happiness and the kidnapping and forced transformation did not work. So I've got to do this alone.
Oh, maybe it was Elvira, or I guess at this time it was Vampyra.
He was maybe like, so.
Oh, Vampyra. Yes. She could have been my companion in the fish world, but alas.
At any rate, the main experiment continues.
Right. So Rex and the in-pit agents, they end up making the connection to Leopold. One of the in-pit agents, I guess Agent Walsh, she figures out that Leopold was working on a lab that was conducting secret experiments with heavy water, and he is attacking his former co-workers from the lab he worked at. And so they ask the sheriff to check on those researchers. And so I guess they're doing that, but then we spend a long time with the monster going out for a walk, just wandering around the streets at night. His posture as he walks, you've mentioned that his posture is awkward, and it's amusing in a way that's difficult to describe. It's kind of like a drunk guy trying to walk through the sand in flip-flops, you know, where it's like hard to get solid footing and you got things coming off your feet. So it's that kind of walk. But another thing about this movie is that it does not follow the Jaws rule. you know, the rule that you should not show too much of your monster until the final act. This movie, the monster is on screen constantly, full view, bright lights. You see the whole thing for minutes at a time. It's just Alf Greedo front and center, wandering through the empty streets at night. You see him break into a drugstore to get some kind of medicine. He smashes a bunch of stuff, I think, because he's upset.
He becomes injured at one point. So not only does the experiment seem to be failing, he becomes perhaps mortally wounded, or at least like heavily wounded, to where he's having to break into a pharmacy and wreck the place and steal some drugs. And so like the whole plan seems to just be going completely off the rails at this point. Now, one of my favorite scenes, and this one, I laughed out loud at this one. This is a scene that that was cut from the MST treatment of the film, and it's ultimately a loss because it's hilarious. There's could have probably been a lot of fun riffing on this one, but it's what I think of as the hippie parade. So the sheriff here, he goes to check on folks in town and finds the youth enjoying a little folk music, clearly in like some sort of abandoned building. And they're hanging out with none other than the actual real life Jamie DeFreitas, who is performing a song, the B-side to World War II Boy, Running Don't Make You Free. And so anyway, the sheriff, you know, he comes in during the midst of this. He sits down and he listens for a spell, you know, perhaps proving that he can hang, you know.
And then he looks like he's enjoying the music.
Yeah, he looks like he's enjoying it. It's like, yeah, this is good. I'm seeing eye to eye with the young folk now.
Quickly, another thing that made me laugh in the scene is that for just a moment, Leopold arrives and is watching through the window, the monster. And he's also ambiguously kind of grooving, but then he just moves on.
It's almost like it was meant to be a music video for this song, you know?
Yeah.
Because again, these songs are featured in their entirety. Nothing is cut.
Yeah.
So the sheriff, he enjoys it for a bit, but he's there with a purpose. He has to protect these hippies. So the sheriff, gets up and leads the hippies all mid song on a police escorted parade through town with Jamie DeFreitas playing the guitar the whole time and singing. And so they have this procession through the small Florida town and then right into the sheriff's office and then right into a jail cell. And it's then explained that this is to keep them safe and that the hippies seem okay with it. But it's not clear for a moment, and I found it kind of perversely humorous. It's like the old sheriff, you think he's seeing eye to eye with the young folk and he's looking after them. No, he's just arresting all of them.
Yeah. But they don't seem bothered by it. Like they all just go into the jail cell and they're just like, cool, man.
Yeah, pretty much. And they're locked up and you never see them in the film again.
Yeah. So a lot of the rest of the movie is just Leopold stalking around, looking at things and menacing people, and then Rex and the in-pit agents trying to track him down. They're on his trail at this point, and they're trying to find him. But at one point, Leopold does is like look through the windows at people and spy on them. Mm-hmm. And at one point, he observes the two in-pit agents kissing. He spies on them through a window, and I guess he gets jealous. So he decides at this point to kidnap Agent Walsh, one of the two in-pit agents, and create another Bride of Catfish, Bride of Catfish 2.0.
Right. So again, really veering off schedule here with the whole plan, because he's again heavily injured at this point, having to self-medicate with stolen pharmacy drugs. But then he's like, I'm gonna try it again. I'm gonna try and transform this woman who is hunting me into my bride.
Yes. So he kidnaps her from her house, takes her back to the lab, and then Rex, Walker, and the cops. Walker is the other in-pit agent. They figure out what's going on, and they're chasing the monster down. And they split up to chase him, and the other in-pit agent, Walker, uses this hilarious-looking amphibious vehicle that looks kind of like a power wheel. It's very small.
It's very cool. I assume from the non-existent in-pit television series that I'm imagining in my head.
Yeah. And coming up is a scene where you see this in-pit agent sort of wading through a swamp and he gets bitten by a snake. And this is another one of those IMDb trivia claims. It claims that the snake bite was not scripted. It was just the guy actually got bitten by a snake while they were filming the scene and they just left it in the movie.
Well,
I don't know. I feel doubtful, but it looks kind of real.
It looks realistic, but I also really like the way it plays into the ending of the picture. Yes. So yeah, for a bit here, we have this kind of double chase where one agent is trying to chase down the monster, and then we have Rex, the marine biologist, and the sheriff. They are going to check out the laboratory to see what's up, see what old Doc Leopold was up to, and then of course we also have Agent Walsh, who has been kidnapped.
Right. So they go to the monster's lair. The sheriff fights the monster and loses and is strangled. So bye bye, sheriff. And then Rex, he comes across Leopold's notes, and he, I think, wants to understand them so he can understand what was going on here. You wonder if it's like that scene in the movie where one scientist discovers what the mad scientist is doing. Like, the good scientist is momentarily tempted. It's the last temptation of the good scientist, and is like, oh, it's genius.
Yeah, but of course, Zat shows up. And violence ensues. He ultimately tries to save Agent Walsh, and I guess to a certain degree succeeds, because what Zat tries to do is he puts her in the cage as well. He injects her with the green stuff, and then he's going to lower her into the Zat baptismal font. But Rex disrupts that, and then Rex is injured, possibly killed by the monster, and the monster runs off.
So I wonder, do all the main characters die? Because we have this chase at the end where Rex tries to save Walsh. You see him get injured and then fall down, but I guess you never see him after that. A similar thing happens to the other in-pit agent. He sort of gets injured and falls down. And at the end of the movie, I think we see him not moving, but it's not clear if he's dead or alive. And you think, well, at least Agent Walsh has been saved. She did not get turned into a catfish, but something bad happened to her. I don't know exactly what it is. She is not upgraded to fish level, but she is sort of turned into a zombie human.
Yeah, so I think she got half the treatment, right? She's injected with the Zat, but then she's not actually lowered into the Zat baptismal font to transform her body. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, the ending of this film, I think, is actually pretty effective. It's haunting and kind of pitch perfect. Because throughout the whole film, we've watched Leopold stumble awkwardly around, his grandiose dreams and voiceover so mismatched with his new body, his actual abilities, his focus, his mixed results. But in the end, against all odds, he achieves his goal for the most part. He struggles and stumbles into the ocean with his Zat formula, like two tanks of it. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, one of the male agent that was snake bit is shooting at him with a rifle and seems to at least wing him, possibly kill him. But he gets that Zat into the ocean. And then meanwhile, even though he's unable to completely transform Agent Walsh into his catfish princess, she wakes in this zombified state. She wanders out onto the beach, and the other agent tries to call to her. He's like, oh, thank goodness you're all right. But she just wanders into the water.
Yep.
Just like a zombie. And yeah, we're left to piece this together, because then we kind of zoom out and some haunting music plays. So we just don't know. Like, is she transformed enough that she'll survive in the water, or is she about to drown? Did enough Zat get into the ocean to bring about this new age of giant fish and bring down humanity? I don't know, but it seems like that might be the case. So it seems like, despite everything, Dr. Leopold has won.
Yeah, I think the implication is that all the human characters die, and he succeeds in throwing his formula into the ocean to create a race of atomic superfish that will conquer the world.
Yeah, it's quite an ending. It ends on a really good note where you kind of forget some of the awkwardness and weirdness and mismatched tonal choices.
Now, another one of the many claims about this movie online is that apparently the movie was originally supposed to end with, or at least include, I think this would be at the ending, giant fish attacks, like a giant catfish that was like rampaging around and destroying the town. And apparently they filmed some versions of this, I think, with miniature models of the town, but then they realized, oh, this does not look good. So they cut that part out of the movie. But one shot from the sequence allegedly made it into the film. Which is where a catfish, like a little catfish, is squirming next to a fence.
Yes, I saw this when I did my recent viewing of Zat Uncut. And yeah, like suddenly there's this brief sequence that looks like poor effects test footage of a walking catfish flopping around on a model of like a, some landscape. So yeah, that seems to match up with what we're seeing here. But there's no context for it. When it actually shows up in the film, you're just kind of like, what? What was that?
So I guess we mentioned the fact that when Dr. Leopold first transforms and looks at himself in a mirror, he says, ah, nothing like a catfish, but it's beautiful. And I wonder, was it intended that he would look nothing like a catfish, even though he is half man, half catfish? Or did they just get whatever costume they could get, and then they're like, oh, we better add a line in here sort of acknowledging that this doesn't look like a catfish?
Yeah, maybe that's how it went down. Or maybe that's what they told themselves. You know, they're like, no, this isn't quite what we went for, but it is beautiful. Let's devote oodles of screen time to it.
So, weirdly, this is not the only killer catfish movie that I've ever seen. It's been many years now, so I've forgotten a lot of the details about it, but I'm pretty sure that I watched a killer catfish movie about 6 or 7 years ago called Beneath, that's about people trapped on a boat who are being stalked on a lake by a killer catfish. And I recall it having a really good, subtle sense of humor. I think it might have been a Larry Fessenden movie.
I just looked it up, and it is. Larry Fessenden is quite a filmmaker. He's made some very interesting genre pictures.
The main moment of this movie that stuck with me is that there's one point where I think one of them has just been attacked by a catfish, and the people remaining alive on the boat, one of them gets up and yells in the direction of the catfish, "What do you want from us?"
Well, clearly it's muck. They're here for the muck. That's what the catfish want.
Yeah, why would catfish want to eat humans? Aren't they just sort of like suck up mud? And I don't know. I should have looked up something about catfish feeding behaviors before I opened my mouth on that. But
it's not a sequel to that.
Not that I can tell.
Okay.
No, it's just like it doesn't look anything like the Greedo elf. It is just a gigantic googly-eyed catfish.
Well, in the end, Zat, there's nothing else quite like it. It is quite an impressive film. Everything in it comes together awkwardly but kind of perfectly, you know? Mm. It's the monster itself as film. Now you might be wondering, where can I watch Zat? Well, Zat has been out on DVD and Blu-ray for years, but it sadly looks like it's out of stock everywhere at this moment as we're recording this. Hopefully that'll change in the future. It's also been available, I think, on Amazon Prime in the recent past, but it's not there right now. But you can watch the MST version, Bloodwaters of Dr. Z. You can digitally obtain that most places, including Amazon Prime. For our copy, again, we rented our copy from Atlanta's own Videodrome. And if you're in Atlanta, you can go there and rent various DVDs and Blu-rays or buy some cool merch. And you can also check them out online at videodrome.tv. And you can buy stuff and they'll ship it to you, which is pretty cool.
They should make Dr. Leopold Head motorcycle helmets. So, you know, it's the Zat monster, but it goes on for the bike ride. In fact, you could do the whole thing, like the leather jacket is a Zat jacket.
Yeah. Oh, well, you know, speaking of that, because that sounds like exactly the kind of thing that Our Land would potentially do. Mm-hmm. If you're listening to this and you don't know the art of Our Land, you can go to ourlandart.com and you can check out some of the stuff that he creates. All right. So there you have it. That's episode 2 in what may be a Florida movie trilogy. We'll see. I'm not sure if we'll be back next week with another Florida movie or the week after that. It kind of depends on Joe's tolerance for all the Florida-ness of these motion pictures.
Oh, you know, I'm generally game.
All right, we'll see. But, you know, sometimes it's nice to have a palate cleanser sometimes between films. So I don't know. We'll see. We'll figure it out. In the meantime, if you'd like to check out other episodes of Weird House Cinema, we publish this every Friday in the Stuff to Blow Your Mind podcast feed. We're primarily a science podcast, and so our primary episodes on scientific topics like the sargassum seaweed, the organism and the environment, those publish on Tuesdays and Thursdays. We publish listener mail on Mondays, and the listener mail covers like everything, Weird House Cinema, but also Stuff to Blow Your Mind. And then on Wednesdays, we publish The Artifact, a short form bit about particular artifacts and moments in time, etc. So check all that out. Wherever you get your podcasts, you can find us, and we just ask that you rate, review, and subscribe if the website allows you to to do that.
Huge thanks, as always, to our wonderful audio producer, Seth Nicholas Johnson. If you would like to get in touch with us with feedback on this episode or any other, to suggest a topic for the future, or just to say hello, you can email us at contact@stufftoblowyourmind.com.
Stuff to Blow Your Mind is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Attention campers, the new Camp Snoopy at Kings Island brings your family summer camp fun all season long. Head to Camp Snoopy with Charlie Brown and the whole Peanuts gang for fun and adventure. Race forwards and backwards on the new family boomerang coaster, Snoopy Soapbox Racers. Explore on your own with more space to roam at Beagle Scout Acres. And don't forget to grab a snack at Pigpen's Mess Hall. It's a new way to play with the Peanuts gang at Camp Snoopy. Now open, only at Kings Island, for the fun of it.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon. Just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan. For data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Constantly making trips to Home Depot? Introducing Drop, the app that rewards you for every shopping trip. Earn free gift cards for shopping. Download the Drop app now and use code DROP33 to get $5 in points.
You wouldn't expect to hear that we're America's third best city for beer like this one. Or home to vibes like this. And this. It might surprise you that we're top 10 for immersive art that's like,
whoa.
And?
Hmm.
Not to mention, we have one of the top zoos in the country. So can a city with the country's best pro soccer team, ranking as a top culinary destination in the world, be in your own backyard? Yes, Columbus. Plan your summer at experiencecolumbus.com/summer.